let me see if I can figure this out. All right. This will hopefully be up in a second. We talked about the fact that there are three major ways to get things into or out of cells, right? What are those three again? No, facilitated diffusion is part of passive transport. Yeah, active transport, passive transport, and vesicular transport. But remember I said that vesicular transport doesn't really involve permeation through a membrane. So it's kind of a special case. In this slide, what we're seeing is just active and passive transport, but it's broken into four examples because there's three distinct kinds of passive transport. I mean, they're all passive, those three, but there's reason for considering them differently. All right, so all passive transport, of course, is passive because the energy that drives that transport is built into the system as in the form of the gradient. So to distinguish the three types, we call it simple diffusion, as you see in A. If that diffusion is occurring directly through the phospholipid bilayer, in other words, without the help or facilitation of a protein. And this occurs for what types of particles? Small nonpolar molecules have no problem slipping right through the phospholipid bilayer because, being hydrophobic, they don't mind being around those hydrophobic tails of the phospholipids. And in this example, you see that CO2 is simply diffusing through the membrane. O2 as well, for that matter. Facilitated diffusion is still diffusion, as the name indicates. So it's still a gradient that's driving that movement, but facilitated means that a protein is required. And there are two distinct types of facilitated diffusion corresponding to the two major types of transport proteins that I introduced last time. What are those two types of proteins? Channel proteins and carrier proteins. So in B here, we have facilitated diffusion using a carrier. What distinguishes a carrier from a channel? Right, a channel is just an opening. I mean, now it can be gated, but it's just a tunnel, whereas a carrier operates based on the change in conformation and involves a temporary binding and then an unbinding of whatever that particle that's being transported is. All right, so we see that for B in glucose. This is a glucose carrier protein. Glucose, though, is in greater abundance outside the cell, in greater concentration outside the cell than inside the cell. That's what qualifies it as diffusion and therefore passive. That's why it doesn't need the help of any outside source of energy. The gradient itself is what's driving it in, but glucose can't slip right through the phospholipid bilayer. It's also not going through a channel. It's binding to a carrier protein, which is then allowing it to go to the other side of the membrane and releasing it. On the other hand, the aquaporin right here, which is an example of a channel protein, allows for movement of water through the membrane. And what is going to determine the direction of that flow of water? The gradient. That's the only thing that can matter for a channel, right? This is why I ended last time saying that if you have a channel protein, then the only kind of transport it's going to be able to work for is passive transport, right? Because if you just have an open hole, the only direction of flow is going to be down the gradient. If you have active transport, on the other hand, which is the fourth example, then the particular, first of all, you need a transport protein for active transport. And when a transport protein is working for the purposes of active transport, we call it a pump. You pump things uphill. If it's a gravitational gradient you're working against, you pump them against the gradient, the opposite direction compared to the way in which they want to move. That's why we call them pumps. So when you hear pump, equate that in your mind with active transporter. But what I started out saying here is that if you're going to try to move something against its gradient via active transport, then you can't use a channel to do that, because opening up a channel is just going to allow it to leak down its gradient. If you want to force something against its gradient, you're going to have to grab onto it, move it to the other side, force it against its gradient, and then release it. That's a carrier protein. But importantly, carrier proteins can work either for facilitated diffusion, which is passive, powered by the gradient, or for active transport, which of course requires additional energy and forces something against its gradient. In the fourth slide, this is just a specific example that shows you kind of cooperativity between the different transport mechanisms, using a blood cell, a red blood cell specifically as an example. Red blood cells are effectively just bags of hemoglobin, because they've lost the typical eukaryotic organelles as part of their development. So there are millions of hemoglobin molecules in each individual erythrocyte or red blood cell, and that's why it specializes for carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide, both of which can bind to hemoglobin at different places on the protein, but hemoglobin carries both oxygen and carbon dioxide. There are two capillary beds that are being represented here. There's a capillary bed, meaning a network of capillaries, surrounding the air sacs in the lung, the alveoli. That's where some exchange takes place, right? Gas exchange takes place at the lungs. But there's also gas exchange that takes place in systemic capillary beds, which means capillary beds around tissues other than the lungs, so the rest of the body. Now, the direction of gas exchange, the direction that each of these two gases is moving, is opposite in the two types of capillary beds. But why is it opposite? Only because the gradients are reversed. It's not because the cell is determining, okay, now I'm at the lung, so I'm going to move these things one way. Now I'm at the tissue, so I'm going to move them the other way. This is happening by diffusion. So the only thing that determines the direction of flow is the direction of the gradient. The reason it's reversed, though, is because of what's happening at these two places. All right, at the lungs, you're breathing in air that has a certain amount of oxygen in it, and that concentration of oxygen is greater than the oxygen concentration in the red blood cell, which is why oxygen now is going to diffuse down its gradient, be dissociated with the hemoglobin, and by simple diffusion, go right through the phospholipid bilayer of the erythrocyte. That's the outward flow of oxygen that we see. The gradient for carbon dioxide at that same place, the lungs, is exactly the opposite direction, simply because there's not all that much CO2 in the air, although sadly we're changing that fact daily. Not nearly as much as what CO2 is in the red blood cell that's coming back from the body. The tissues have dumped CO2 into the red blood cell, basically. So the gradient is in a direction for CO2 to leave at the lungs, go into the cell at the tissues. All right, but the CO2 here and the O2, even though they're going in opposite directions based on their gradient, the CO2 is doing something different because the CO2 is involved in an important chemical reaction that occurs in your cells that acts as an important buffering system. So CO2, CO2 and water, when they mix, when they come into contact, can undergo a chemical reaction to produce, it doesn't show it right here, but CO2 and H2O combine to form, anyone know? It's a two-step, actually, they show it as one step here, but it's really two steps. What does CO2 and water produce? It's... Yes, carbonic acid, which is what? As a symbol. Yes. H2CO3 is carbonic acid. Well, carbonic acid doesn't stay as carbonic acid very long. It will dissociate into, as acids do, a hydrogen ion and what's left. So H plus, and what is the other thing? HCO3 minus. That's why it's just showing you the final step here instead of it's skipping this intermediate step. So the carbonic acid dissociates into hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions. And therefore the bicarbonate ion is really carrying the CO2, right? Because the CO2 was on the other end. It gets transformed into bicarbonate ions, and this is how a bunch of your CO2 gets carried around in the blood. But notice that the bicarbonate ions, as they build up, because of Le Chatelier's principle, when CO2 comes in at the body tissues, that's going to drive this reaction to the right, right? That's going to cause buildup of bicarbonate ion, and it's going to then be transported out of the cell in exchange for chloride ions, a negative for a negative, so that there isn't any net change. All you're doing is swapping one anion for another anion. So that involves a facilitated diffusion. The protein that does this is acting as a transport protein, but it's really doing a dual job. It's moving two different particles at the same time. All right? Now, that when you have that happen, one transporter moving two different particles at the same time, that's a co-transporter. But there are two subdivisions, two categories of co-transporters. One possibility is that the two different things being moved are moved in the same direction at the same time, in which we call that symport, sim meaning together, right? That's not what's happening here, because here we're swapping them. So a co-transporter that operates by moving one particle in one direction while the other particle moves in the other direction is an example of antiport. And so this is what basically happens. This happens because of the buildup of bicarbonate, which is brought on by buildup of CO2 from the body tissues. All right. Now, at the lung, at the other end, when the blood gets back to the lungs, everything is reversed. CO2 is unloaded from the cell so that it's put into the lungs for you to exhale. Well, by Le Chatelier's principle, when you take something away from the left side, that's going to shift everything to the left to make up for that absence of CO2, right? And that means carbonic acid is going to form CO2 and H2O in order to make up for that loss of CO2. Carbonic acid disappearance means now you need to make some carbonic acid to make up for the fact that it has disappeared. And you make more carbonic acid by bringing together bicarbonate ions and hydrogen ions, which means the whole thing shifts to the left. Well, to make up for the loss of bicarbonate ions, they come in from the extracellular fluid through this antiporter, but the two gradients are now reversed. So chloride now is swapped for bicarbonate in the opposite direction. And this just happens over and over in your cells. Yeah.
So for the antiporter, can we use anything except chloride ion, or because it has to be chloride?
No, there's the only thing that qualifies as antiport is that the two things are being moved in opposite directions. And there's all kinds of different antiporters or antiport proteins. In this particular example, it's chloride, yes. But each transporter is specific. Yeah. It is a carrier because it temporarily binds to them and changes shape in order to work. But it's facilitated diffusion because it's happening because of the gradient. It's not moving them against their gradient. All right, now to five. So we've been already talking about diffusion, but I haven't really said much about it specifically other than it occurs down a gradient. Diffusion is, of course, a passive process. We've already established that. But diffusion, and this kind of sounds surprising when you phrase it this way, diffusion is a directed process, meaning it has a certain direction. It occurs in, at least net diffusion, occurs in one direction, right? From high to low concentration, namely. Despite being caused by a random process, a random movement of particles. Okay, so diffusion happens because particles are moving continuously. If that weren't true, there wouldn't be any diffusion. And that movement of individual particles in a fluid, whether it's a liquid or a gas, is random. Every individual particle is moving at any given moment in time. Every particle is moving in a certain direction at its own speed. And so it's just like billiard balls right after the moment of contact in a break. It's all random. That random movement of particles is called Brownian motion. And Brownian motion is what actually causes diffusion, but it's random movement of particles that leads to a directed diffusion in one direction. Let me use an analogy with people as a description of this. This is just in two dimensions to make it simpler, but it's really occurring in three dimensions. If I assemble 100 people or so in a big room, like a gymnasium, and I have them, each one represents a particle, a solute particle of the same type, then we can stop time to set up this experiment, and I can gather them all in the middle of the floor, but randomize them with respect to the direction they're facing, because the direction they're facing is going to represent the direction the particle will move when we start time. Okay? So they're all facing random directions, but they're huddled in the middle. If I then start time, then each person will represent particle motion by walking in whatever direction they are facing, right? And they'll keep walking in a straight line until they hit something else, either another particle, another person, or a wall. Well, right when I start time, there's going to be a bunch of colliding of people together, right? all of the people that are in the interior of that mass won't be able to walk very far. They're just going to be bouncing around, and when they hit, they change directions. So they have to move to a different point in a different direction, and then keep walking until they hit something else. So none of the people in the interior is going to make it very far. But then you have the people on the periphery. There's a ring of people on that edge, if we make it a circle, right? Well, some of those won't be able to walk very far either, because they will just be randomly facing inwardly. So they're going to run into people too. Some of them, though, will be facing exteriorly, and they will be able to move away from the group. And so they will walk away until they hit a wall. Well, the more people move away from the group, the more likely it is that other people will still be able to also escape. And so it's random movement, but it causes directed overall movement of the particles from high concentration to low concentration. That's the way diffusion always happens. And diffusion doesn't require any membrane. For instance, you plop a cube of sugar into a cup of water, there's going to be diffusion of sugar from where there is more of it, the cube itself, to where there's none of it at first, the water. And at the same time, there's going to be diffusion of water from where it's watery, pure water originally, to where the sugar is. So you have two different types of particles diffusing at the same time down their own gradient in that example. And that's simple diffusion for both of those particles. You can also, though, have simple diffusion through a membrane, which is what's represented here in A. The U-tube here has a membrane right at the bottom, vertically situated, represented by the dashed line. And this membrane, in this case, is permeable to whatever the solute represented by the black dots is. But notice that at time zero, before you let anything happen, there is a higher black dot solute concentration on the left side than there is in the right side. Therefore, a gradient is in place, and since it's able to permeate through that membrane, that means black particles are going to move from left to right as net diffusion. Now, there's nothing saying that a particle can't move from right to left, and that's going to happen. But at first, if you start out with none on the right, of course, there's not going to be any movement of from right to left. As soon as you have, and therefore all of the movement of black particles is going to be from left to right. As soon as you have some on the right side, they're free to move back to the left, and that's going to happen. But as long as there's a difference in the concentration, it's going to be more likely for that movement to be from higher concentration to lower concentration. So when we talk about net diffusion, that's what's directed. Individual particles still might be moving in the opposite direction, but as a whole, on average, the net diffusion is in one direction, always toward lower concentration. Now that's simple diffusion through a membrane. Osmosis is shown on the bottom, and it is really just a special decase of diffusion. There's a couple things that make it a special case. Most biology textbooks will describe osmosis as movement of water molecules. Blah, blah, blah. That's really, that's simply because in biology the solvent is always water. But really, osmosis, chemically, osmosis applies to any solvent. So it doesn't have to be water. But that's one of the things that makes it a special case. Usually when we just talk about simple diffusion and don't use the word osmosis, we're talking about movement of solute particles from high concentration to low concentration. when we talk about osmosis, it's movement of solvent particles, not solute particles. The other thing that makes it a special case is it's not osmosis unless that movement of solvent particles occurs through a selectively permeable membrane. So when I talked about plopping the sugar cube into water, I said that that was simple diffusion of water molecules when the water moves toward the sugar. There's no membrane involved there. That is not osmosis. It's just two different types of particles moving each down its own concentration gradient. Okay, so that's what osmosis is. Movement of solvent particles through a semipermeable membrane because of a gradient. Now, another thing that most textbooks do is phrase this in a way that almost seems backwards, even though it's not. So a textbook will say something like osmosis is movement of water from a place of low solute concentration to a place of high solute concentration. That's true, but saying it that way makes it sound like it's going against a gradient, right? Because you're used to talking about movement from high concentration to low concentration. The reason it's phrased that way, though, is because the solutes really are determining the concentration of water. If you think about what low solute concentration means from the viewpoint of water, what does that mean? Low solute concentration means high solvent concentration, right? A low solute concentration means watery, very watery. And a high solute concentration means less watery. So it is true that osmosis occurs from a place of low solute concentration to high solute concentration. That's just a backwards way of saying that water is moving down its own gradient from a place of high water concentration to a place of low water concentration. So it is just diffusing. The thing that makes it osmosis, which is just a special case of diffusion, is that it's first of all water, a solvent rather than a solute, and it's going through a membrane when it diffuses. Okay? Now, this happens when the membrane through which osmosis occurs is not permeable to at least some of the solutes that are in the solutions on either side of the membrane. Okay? And that's what's happening here in the YouTube. This is a different YouTube setup on the bottom. But you still have a membrane in the middle. In this case, though, the membrane is impermeable to the triangular solute particles. You don't see individual water particles here, but they make up the blueness. It's permeable to water, though, just not to the solutes. Well, if we start this out with pure water on the... which is not pictured here, but if we started out with pure water on the right and some concentration of particles, triangular solute particles on the left, then there's a gradient in place, right? There's two gradients in place, importantly. There's a gradient for the solutes, and there's a gradient for the water particles. The solutes, by virtue of their gradient, in a sense, make them want to diffuse. But importantly, there are two requirements for diffusion to occur. You have to have a gradient. If you talk about movement from A to B, wherever those places are, for diffusion to happen from A to B, there has to be a gradient from A to B. That's one requirement. The other requirement, though, is that there has to be a way for that particle to get from A to B. And so the gradient itself is not enough. It's absolutely required. It's just not sufficient. If it's blocked, of course, it's trying to diffuse, but it won't be able to. That's what's happening here, because the membrane is impermeable to the solutes. Now, one gradient has nothing to do with the other gradient. They operate independently, and they determine movement of only that type of particle. So the gradient for triangular solute particles is not driving water movement. The only thing that drives water movement is its own gradient. But water's concentration is affected by the concentration of the solutes, right? So once again, if we started with pure water on the right and triangular solute solution on the left, that means that the right, which is pure water, is going to have a higher water concentration. You can't be more watery than water. And less of a water concentration on the left. That is the reason that water is going to move. But the presence of those solute particles made that solution less watery. That's the point here. So water is going to move by osmosis from where there is more water always, where it's more watery, to where it's less watery. In this case, it's going to move from the right to the left side. Now, let's look at what's actually represented here rather than what I said starting with pure water. We didn't start with pure water here. We started with the same kind of solution, but it's a more dilute solution on the right than on the left. Water is going to move by osmosis, but the moment that both solutions have the same solute concentration, which is just another way of saying the same wateriness, then there won't be any there's no longer any water concentration gradient, and therefore there's no more tendency to osmose. Right? Well, if you're taking water out of the right side and you're putting it into the left side, that means the volume on the right side is decreasing, and the volume on the left side is increasing. So that in this U tube, the level in the left gets high, the level in the right gets low. But it will come to equilibrium if the gradient is dissipated. Just like if you have, the same amount of bicarbonate, same concentration of bicarbonate ions on either side of a membrane, that's at equilibrium. There's going to be no tendency to go in either direction. So that's one way that this can come to equilibrium osmotically. But if we did it my way with pure water on the right, still going to happen that water is going to leave the right side and go into the left, and therefore the level on the right is going to drop, and it's going to increase on the right, on the left, I mean. But doesn't matter how much that happens, whatever's still left behind on the right side will be pure water still. And therefore it will still be more watery than the right side, you're diluting the left side more and more, but it still has some solute, which is more than zero that's on the right side, right? So it would never come to equilibrium because of an elimination of the gradient. Osmotically, water would still want to be going toward the left. It will come to equilibrium, though, for another reason. The taller this column in the left gets, the more gravity is pulling down on it, which is trying to push water for a different reason, not osmotically, but for pressure reasons, toward the right. When that gravitational force exactly equals the osmotic force, which is in the opposite direction, then it will be at equilibrium for a different reason. Yeah.
So, what's the example of a membrane for this kind of situation?
Well, this really mimics what the plasma membrane is largely, because plasma membrane is not freely permeable to most ions, right? Unless there are specific transporters for those ions. If we're talking about just phospholipid bilayer is not permeant to ions, even small ones, freely. Because they're ions, right? They're fully charged, and they're therefore hydrophilic.
But I'm trying to say, like, membrane?
Well, the membrane's not U-shaped here. The tube is. Yeah, the membrane is just right here. It's a circular piece of membrane. If you looked at it from this direction, it would be a circular membrane, just not allowing for anything, any passage except through that membrane. Okay, now to 6. Now, I'm sure you've heard all these three terms before, all of them ending in tonic. Hypertonic, isotonic, hypotonic. These are 3 degrees of tonicity. These words are misused all the time by people who should know better, even. You should never apply these adjectives to a cell. These words don't describe a cell. These words describe the environment around the cell. In other words, the surrounding solution. Whether it's a beaker of water that you put a cell into, or extracellular fluid that occurs naturally. So it's not the cell that's hypertonic or hypotonic or isotonic. It's the medium that is one of those 3. Tonicity, though, refers to osmotic tendency. And so there's also potential confusion about the meaning of these words because of what the prefixes actually indicate. Now, hyper means what? Just by itself.
Over.
Over, right. And hypo, under, right? Hypodermic is under the skin. Despite the fact that water is the only thing moving here by osmosis, not the solutes, because they're blocked by the membrane, a hypertonic solution is called that because it has a relatively higher concentration of solutes. So the prefix really refers to the solute concentration, even though what really is moving is the solvent, the water, not the solutes. Okay? But that's the way you should think of it. If you know that hyper means above, then hypertonic must mean having a higher concentration of solutes than the cell itself. That's what's always being compared here. These words are only relative. There's no such thing as a hypertonic solution, period. Saying that it's hypertonic means that it has a higher solute concentration than a cell that's in it does. Okay? That same solution might be hypotonic compared to a different kind of cell, for instance, or a different kind of container with a membrane. But hypertonic, since it means having a higher solute concentration than the cell itself does, means what with respect to wateriness? It's less watery than the cell. That's what a hypertonic solution is. And that's why it's confusing, because hyper, meaning above, actually means less watery. All right? Well, it's the wateriness that really matters as far as osmosis is concerned, because osmosis is just diffusion down a gradient. So a cell that happens to be in a hypertonic solution is more watery than that solution because this hypertonic solution is less watery. Water, if osmosis is going to occur, which it will if there's a gradient, is always going to move from more watery to less watery, which is why a cell in a hypertonic solution will lose water by osmosis, as you see in the picture here. That, of course, is going to decrease the volume of the cell because you're losing water without replacing it. On the top row of pictures here, we have a typical animal cell. Could be a red blood cell or any other kind of animal cell, really. On the bottom, a plant cell by comparison. Now, what's the fundamental difference here between animal and plant cell? Right, the existence or the absence of a cell wall. Animal cells don't have cell walls. All cells have plasma membranes, of course, including the plant cell. But in addition to that plasma membrane, a plant cell has a much thicker and fairly rigid cell wall exterior to that plasma membrane. Well, an animal cell in a hypertonic solution will lose water and therefore volume, and since the plasma membrane, which is the only covering, is so pliable, the whole cell will just shrivel. What do we call that shriveling? called crenation, with an N, not an M, but spelled just like cremation. So this cell is crenating. That's bad for the health of the animal cell, which is why animal cells don't do well in a hypertonic environment. A plant cell, on the other hand, has the cell wall. And that cell wall is very thick. It can change shape a little bit, but it's not pliable like the plasma membrane. So when the water leaves the plant cell, which it will for the same reason in a hypertonic solution, because it's more watery inside the cell, when that water leaves, the plasma membrane, which is immediately around that water, will shrink, but it'll peel away from the cell wall. So the plasma membrane is like the paint on the wall of this room, if this were paint. Is it? Yeah, it is. Whereas the wall itself is like the cell wall. To remain healthy, that plasma membrane needs to be up against that cell wall. Well, when it peels away because of osmotic loss of water in the face of hypertonicity, that's called plasmolysis. And this is a plasmolyzed cell that we're looking at here. That's also unhealthy. So plants don't do well in a hypertonic solution either. Let's look at the other extreme. Hypo, meaning below, refers to the solutes, remember. So a hypotonic solution is one that has a lower solute concentration than the cell, which is just a backwards way of saying that it is more watery than the cell, which is what really matters. So any cell in a hypotonic environment is going to feature osmotic uptake of water. Water is going to go into the cell. In the case of an animal cell or any other cell that doesn't have a cell wall, that's going to bulge this plasma membrane outward, right? It can take a little bit of pressure, but there's a limit, of course. And so if it's a hypotonic enough solution, or if it's the cell is in that environment for long enough, so much water will be imbibed that it will cause bursting, and we call that lysis. Now, another bit of confusion is that lysis is the ending of the word plasmolysis, but plasmolysis is happening for a the opposite reason. Plasmolysis is caused by loss of water, whereas lysis is caused by uptake of water. Well, that happens in an animal cell, because animal cells don't have that strong cell wall. But a plant cell, on the other hand, can take that pressure. There will be, of course, osmotic uptake of water in a hypotonic environment. But as the water comes into the cell, that's going to put pressure on the cell wall more and more. It can withstand the pressure, though, because of its fairly rigid stature. And so the cell becomes turgid or swollen. This is another form of equilibrium, right? When the cell wall is pushing back on the fluid with exactly the same force that osmosis is applying to bring in the water, it's just like the U-tube with gravity. Now there is no more osmosis net. Water is coming out and going into the cell at the same rate. So there's no more change in volume. Well, that actually is the preferred environment for a plant cell. Keeps that plasma membrane nicely stuck up against the cell wall, and it's a nice healthy cell by itself. Now, not only that, plants are not unicellular organisms, of course, right? If you imagine the entire body of a plant, if it's a non-woody plant, even if it's a tree doesn't start out as woody, right? You have a little seedling that is all soft tissue, basically. It's made of millions of cells, though. And if you provide enough water for the environment to be hypotonic, the cells will take up that water by osmosis. Each individual cell will become turgid, but that means every adjacent pair of cells will be pushing on each other. And this causes an erection in the plant. Analogous to the erection of a penis, but it's a little bit different. It's blood pressure in a penis, it's osmotic pressure in a plant. But those cells are pushing against each other, and that's what holds the stem up before it gets woody. I figured there would be a little chuckling there. Now, if you forget to water the plant, eventually the environment's no longer going to be hypotonic, right? And so it's going to lose water, and the plant cells will become flaccid, limp, and they're not pushing on each other, and therefore it droops over. Now, if you water it in time, you can cause another erection. ISO means what? Equal. So an isotonic solution simply means that there is the same solute concentration in that fluid than there is in the cell. There therefore is no net osmosis, but importantly, there's water moving into and out of the cell continuously. It's just that there's outward movement at the same rate as inward movement, so there's no net movement. By the way, it's important to realize that you can have an isotonic solution that has a totally different type or set of solutes compared to the solutes that are in the cell. So the type of solute for osmosis does not matter at all. And that's because the solutes are not really what's driving it, right? It's the wateriness. So if you have a 1 molar solution of sodium ions on the outside and a 1 molar solution of chloride ions on the inside of the cell, totally different types of solutes, right? But the fact that those are both 1 molar concentrations means that they're equally watery. So that would be an isotonic solution, even though it's a totally different chemical type of environment. Water wouldn't want to move into or out of the cell more than the other way, because it's just as watery inside as out. Now, chloride would want to be moving out, and sodium would want to be moving in because they have their own gradients in place, but they don't fulfill the requirement of being able to get from A to B, which is why they wouldn't. All right, I can see whether I can get through 7. We're looking at 2 traces on this graph, obviously. The green one is illustrating the relationship for facilitated diffusion, whereas red is simple diffusion, but notice what's being graphed here. Rate of diffusion versus solute concentration, gradient. Delta, bracket S, the gradient. Okay, so that means you're talking about 2 different places, A and B, and the difference between them is what's increasing as we go to the right. Obviously, if there were no gradient, then there would be no diffusion, either facilitated or simple, right? The point here, though, is that simple diffusion has a linear relationship when you make the concentration greater, or the gradient greater and greater, or steeper and steeper, meaning a bigger and bigger difference, then that's going to cause more particles in the same amount of time to move through the membrane. That kind of makes common sense, right? It's not a linear relationship for facilitated diffusion, though. It levels off at high concentration gradients. And this is because of saturation. When you have to involve transport proteins, which is by definition what facilitated diffusion does, well, there's a finite amount of proteins. And any given protein is either vacant at the time or being used at the time. You're going to use more and more of them at any given moment, the steeper the gradient is. Just like my analogy of turnstiles at a stadium, I think I used, right? When you have a huge crowd trying to get in, making an even bigger crowd is not going to cause more people to get in at any in a unit of time, because you've already saturated all those turnstiles. So that's why it's not a linear relationship. When you saturate all the available transport proteins, additional gradient is not going to help.